Okay, good evening again, everybody. Now that we're on tape, I can officially welcome everybody to what is already shaping up to be a beautiful weekend of learning and enjoyment and meeting people and seeing people you haven't seen for a while. And it's really a pleasure to be here and to welcome everybody. And since we already did a little welcome, we want to keep more or less on schedule. I'm going to introduce Lazer Friedman, who I really want to thank. It's really on the medical side for really organizing the whole thing and the scheduling and the speakers, et cetera, putting our beautiful booklet all together. And I want to thank him for all his help. If you don't know him, you'll meet him over the weekend. Of course, I want to thank our sponsoring organizations who've helped to make it possible. Yeshiva University, Rabbi Brander is coming. He was here. And the Orthodox Union, HOTS, the halachic organ donor, that you see their information outside. Also Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, a couple of the drug companies, Sparing and Ducheney, that are drug companies who've helped, and we want to thank them all for their part in making this all possible. And we want to mainly thank you for coming and being here and making this into the program as will be. So without further ado, I want to thank Lazer, and I'm going to ask him to introduce our speakers.
Thank you, Rabbi Jay. Thank you all for coming, and Baruch Hashem, I can tell you we're ready to go. I just want to just give a brief overview of just what we're going to hope to do over the next couple of weeks, couple of days now. Really, just more to talk about some of the ins and outs for the medical people in terms of the CME and things like that. So, just a couple of items first of all. Hopefully you all have received the book and you're going to register. We'll try to keep to the program as much as possible within allowances. We understand Jewish time, but we need to probably try very hard to stick on our program. Tonight we have some room, so it's not such a big issue, but tomorrow certainly that means coming on time, starting on time, and continuing on. Jay, did you mention already davening tomorrow? You took care of that. Thank you, I wasn't there. Good. Okay, inside you will find the yellow sheets is the schedule, the green sheets for those that need accreditation. For those of you that are family physicians and need specifically from the College of the Canadian College, please speak to me afterwards and I'll let you know where we stand with the Canadian College, and certainly we can arrange for that. If you're a specialist, the papers are in the handout. And if you are from the States, then the AMA credits are already put in there. In order for everyone to receive their accreditation, the committee still has work to do, and part of that is making sure that evaluation forms are completed. So it fulfills two roles. One is it helps us to know what we've done, where we're going, and certainly for future planning. But more importantly, for those that are looking for CMA accreditation and they want their points, in order for this to be accredited completely, this is being done through McGill University. So I please, I think you get the point, ask you to complete those forms and by the end of the event, so even if you're leaving at the last hour, don't leave it to the last hour. A, please complete them as you go along, and B, if you're going to be leaving, just pass them along to the front. We'll have a little box certainly over the course of time. We appreciate that Shabbat there's going to be an opportunity, not going to be an opportunity to fill them out, but please do that again. It's so important in terms of accreditation, otherwise that McGill University is very strict about these items. I think that's all for the housekeeping items. We'll move right along with the programs this evening. It gives me really a great source of pleasure to introduce our speakers this evening. Our first speaker, the truth is all of our speakers over this weekend are, just so you appreciate, they are world-class, outstanding Talmidei Chachamim, scholars, Rabbonim, medical doctors, incredible amounts of knowledge, and more in terms of the synthesis of Torah Mada that they have accomplished. So it's really an honor to actually hear all of them, and presumably that's exactly why you're here. Rabbi Professor Dr. Avram Steinberg, to anyone who has been doing any sort of reading in medical ethics, needs no introduction. And Kol Hamosif Goreya, if I were to continue, I would actually be taken away. But at least the Rashi Prakim Rabbi Steinberg comes from Israel, and he is, I don't even know where to begin. He is essentially, he works at the Shaarei Tzedek Hospital as the director of the medical ethics unit. That is one of his babies, so to speak. He is an international consultant and speaker on the topic of medical ethics. His night seder is that he is now editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit. So if any of you are familiar with that work of we are talking about, that is, as he described it to me, his night seder, that he edits, you know, Sfarim. And as I said, that's the kind of nature, the nature of the individual we are going to be dealing with tonight. And over the weekend. I really don't think I want to continue on because, I'm going to leave out more than I'm going to be able to do. The last thing probably just in terms of our conferences is if you're, any of you are familiar with a medical encyclopedia on medical ethics, it was written by Professor Avram Steinberg, and it's a single author, which is unheard of in today's world to be an author of a single encyclopedia. This is not like the editor of multiple editions that were there. Six volumes in Hebrew, three in English. I'm not sure how they did that. It's usually the other way around, but somehow that's what it is. Without further ado, let me introduce, please, Rabbi Steinberg, please come up and give some talk.
Thank you very much, and good evening to everyone. פותחים בכבוד אכסניה תחילה. Really, the אכסניה we are in, the physical אכסניה, is really magnificent. It was a good choice on the part of the organizers. But actually, the אכסניה is not the physical אכסניה, but the spiritual אכסניה. And it gives me really great pleasure to honor the organizers who took upon themselves to organize for us such an inspiring long weekend on issues of medicine halacha. I would like to thank Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Friedman and everyone else who helped here to organize this convention, and to thank them for inviting me to share with you some of the issues. The topic that I was assigned was phrased as, is halacha compatible with modern medicine, in a question mark. I assume it was done so in either a rhetoric way or a provocative way, because the answer obviously is, as it says here, halacha is compatible with modern medicine, and I'll try to show you just a little bit how it works together, although this topic really can be discussed throughout the whole weekend and not even finishing it. Let me start with issues of modern medicine that created the problems of halachic relationship to them and, in general, ethical relationships to them. There are a few issues that intensified the problem. It is not to say that we in the 21st century invented the problem of medicine and halacha, or ethics in medicine, or any of these combinations. They were with humanity since we can remember human beings thinking and writing. However, the last five, six decades really are very different substantially from the rest of human history. And I enumerated here a few issues, not all of them, and I won't discuss all of them because that is just to show why the issue exists. And I would begin with the unprecedented rapid scientific advances. Let's take end-of-life issues. 100 years ago, 500 years ago, people died as they die today. Nothing has changed in the fact that people are dying. Yet the problems, the actual problems involved with decision-making in end of life 500 years ago are totally not even similar to the issues that are with us today. There were no respirators, there were no dialysis machines, there was no chemotherapy, There were no surgeries. There were no advanced medications. So the theoretical question whether one should prolong life or not prolong suffering one way or the other was really a very minute issue, because in practice there was little to be done. Today the issues are very, very complicated because we have so many possibilities to prolong life. Same holds true for issues that weren't even dreamt as a possibility. Organ transplantation, fertility technologies of modern times, obtaining eggs and sperm and fertilizing them and getting a surrogate mother to have the child being born not from the genetic parents, and so on and so forth, issues that did not even exist 50 years ago, and yet they are common practice today, and there are ethical halachic issues involved with them. So that almost every topic we'll touch is very different today than it was in the past. Second major change that occurred in the last 50, 60 years, which came quite in parallel with the scientific advancements, is the major change in the patient-physician relationship. Up to about 50, 60 years ago, since Hippocrates' times and maybe earlier, the pattern of a patient-physician relationship was a paternalistic relationship, whereby the physician made all the decisions on behalf of the patient, assuming or stating that he knows better what is good for the patient. And hence, the patient should not be even involved in knowing what decisions he should take. This has totally changed, and today we are talking about an autonomous patient-physician relationship, whereby the one to make decisions is the patient, not the physician. The physician has become a mechanic, a technician, who is giving information, but the decision really is in the hands of the patient. A major change with a lot of ramifications. What do you disclose to a patient in order for him to make a decision? How far do you tell him? What is an informed consent? Not a consent, not signing a paper, but an informed consent. How far does the patient really understand the facts in order to make an informed consent? These are fundamental changes that occurred in the last few years. There are other issues of similar importance, which I won't go into. I'm just trying to point out at the beginning that indeed there is a major ethical, halachic issue involved in modern medicine almost in every field, which most of it is new in the way it has to be affected. Here is an example of a few of the issues that modern medicine brings to us, some of which will be discussed throughout this conference, so we won't discuss them in details, but each and every line in this example sheet is a major halachic ethical problem. Now, I want to start with some concepts from a general medical ethical point of view, and then compare it to a Jewish point of view, and finally show you how all this can be meshed together and how it is being done lately in the state of Israel. So from a historic point of view, the first document that we have about ethical procedures in medicine was a document by the pupils of Hippocrates 2,500 years ago or more. Thomas Percival, who was a physician, wrote a detailed paper on how to behave ethically towards patients. These were individuals who were physicians who wrote how physicians should behave towards patients. That became even stronger when the American Medical Association in 1847 and the British Medical Association in 1857 published for the first time a document which states how a physician should behave towards patients. And it enlarged in the Geneva Declaration of the WHO, and since there were many more documents of this sort. Now, if we look at the Oath of Hippocrates, I don't know how many of you have read it altogether and how many of you who read it ever remember what it says, but it is a totally irrelevant document to our times. Totally irrelevant. There are still medical schools who take this oath as a sign of their finishing, graduating medicine, but it is totally irrelevant, both by the content, by the philosophical basis of it, and I won't go into details, but that really is not very helpful. Why is it so? Because modern medical ethics is a multidisciplinary, pluralistic approach based on much more than medicine itself. It is based on philosophy and law and religion and history and behavioral and social sciences. In other words, a modern document of medical ethics is not written by physicians. Physicians may be part of it, usually a small part of it. It is written by society, by representatives of society who want a certain way of ethical behavior of physicians towards patients, not done by physicians themselves, that they should keep the right way. So it is a totally different approach nowadays. And in Georgetown, the mantra of Georgetown was formulated into four major ethical principles. I assume it's known to everyone here: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. I won't go into the details of it. I'll say a few words when I'll compare it to the Jewish way on how ethical principles should have been written, not in that fashion. But I want to point out two major problems with modern bioethics, the way Georgetown and other faculties have formulated bioethics today. One is the balancing between values, and the other one is the missing of a value, which is the value of life. If we'll go back a minute and we'll look at what today every medical student who studies ethics is taught, is that he should beware of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. The value of life as such is totally omitted. And it is not an accident. It was done deliberately for reasons that I don't have time now to go into. So I think that is a major problem in the approach of modern medical ethics. But the real problem is the application of those principles. There is a moral polarity in each and every of the issues that we'll discuss in this conference and many more issues. One can go to extremes on almost every issue that we take and justify it. I won't go into the principles themselves. Again, that will take us a long time. But take, for instance, abortion. One can be a pro-life proponent and say that the fetus is a full human being and hence never is it allowed to abort a fetus. On the other hand, the pro-choice philosophy says the fetus is just an appendix of the mother, and therefore, the same way as a mother is allowed to cut her hair or nail, she is allowed to take away the fetus, which is part of her body. These are two totally, extremely opposing viewpoints which can be justified on a philosophical level. If you take a terminally ill patient, how do we approach to him? One way can be he is suffering, he doesn't want to live anymore, he will die of his disease only in 5, 6, 8 months from now, but he doesn't want those 8 or 6 months. He is suffering. He wants to die now. How can he die now if I'll kill him? That is called, in nice words, euthanasia. And that can be justified on the basis that the autonomous wish of the suffering, dying patient is to die now. Why shouldn't I help him? The opposing viewpoint is that the value of life is of infinite value, and something in mathematics which is infinite means that there is no exception to the rule, so that 70 years are not more important than one day or even 1 hour. And the same way as I am obligated to prolong a life of someone who has an expectation to live another 70 years, I should do the same efforts to prolong his life for a day, even though he is suffering, even though he doesn't want it, because life is of infinite value. So on these opposing values, how do you act when you want to treat a terminally ill patient? And we can go on and show the extremes of positions in ethics, and the question is, how do we decide in such manners? And the answer of modern medical ethics is autonomy. That has become the key word. Whatever you deal with, you have to respect the autonomy of the patient. So it became actually an overriding ethical principle, which is based on respect for intrinsic value, for freedom, self-determination, ownership of self, and better knowledge of what is my personal good. These are the justifications for autonomy. All are correct. The question is, how far do we go with it? Is it really an overriding principle, an absolute principle, or is it a relative principle where other principles may sometimes override it? Now, remember, in the four principles, autonomy is one of four. It is not an overriding principle by the definition of the four principles. They are supposed to be equal. But when you come to deal with beneficence and you ask, what is beneficence? How do I know what is beneficial to the patient? The answer of modern ethics is, ask the patient. So if you ask the patient anyway, where is beneficence? It doesn't stand on its own legs at all. If I want to do good to someone else, and in my opinion, to do good to him is to do X, but he says, I don't want it, I want Y, and I know that Y is bad for him, but who am I to say it if autonomy overrides it? So in fact, from the four principles, we really come down to only one principle, which is the principle of autonomy. Now, autonomy by all is accepted that there are limitations to it. For instance, you need to be competent in order to express your autonomy. If you ask a three-year-old child, do you want this operation or not, what meaning does it have if he says, I don't want it or I want it? There's no autonomy there because the agent, the child, is not an autonomous agent. If someone is comatose or in a persistent vegetative state, where's his autonomy? How do I know what he really wants? So, obviously, autonomy is limited only to competent people. Now, how do you define competency? Which is a major psychological, psychiatric, scientific problem. Are we sitting here in this room competent people? Do we do right by sitting here and listening to a lecture rather than going out and take a walk in nature? Is it competency? I mean, competency is a very difficult concept. Autonomy is limited by no harm to others. I can say autonomously that your shirt is very nice and I want it. The fact that I autonomously want it doesn't mean that I can take it because I'm causing harm to someone else's autonomy. So my autonomy comes short to someone else's autonomy. But what do you do when two autonomies are contradicting each other? Whose autonomy overrides? Autonomy has to be accepted within societal norms. If society feels that something is absolutely wrong in this particular society, an autonomous person cannot do different than what society decided. A very frequent example to it is using a car seat belt that is imposed on everyone for his benefit. But if I'm an autonomous agent, and I say, I don't care that you think it's good for me. I don't want to wear the belt while I'm driving. I want to be free to move. If a policeman catches me without it, he fines me. How can he do it? I autonomously decided I don't want it. And you're telling me that the consequences are worse if you are not belted compared to with a belt. That is my decision to make. Who are you to impose on me? And yet we're imposing it on you. Because society thinks that this autonomy is wrong for the benefit of the patient. So where do you set the limits? When can society decide that your autonomy is ridiculous and shouldn't be respected? There are other issues that I don't want to go into at the moment, but you can see that there are limitations even for those who believe that autonomy is an overriding principle. But there are significant cultural differences in the perception of autonomy. First of all, there are societies, not in the United States, not in Canada, but in other not less developed and civilized societies, where autonomy is not so much respected. There are other values that particular societies feel that are more important than autonomy, one of which is Judaism. We cannot be autonomous in the sense of modern medical ethics. We cannot decide autonomously to write a letter on Shabbat because we are free then and that is the best time for us to write a letter. We can't do it. We have an obligation not to do it, and if we do it, we are punishable by Jewish law. So our autonomy is quite limited. It's not zero, but it's certainly limited. So cultural, religious differences limit autonomy in a much greater way than modern Western societies. There are other such limitations which have to be accounted for. Another issue is, if we have an ethical dilemma, who decides? Who makes a decision? The more people involved in the decision-making process, the more opinions there will be there. Today, someone has calculated that in a teaching university, one patient is being taken care of by almost 100 people. Every patient. He has a physician that is an expert to his left ear, and another physician who is an expert to his right nail, and so many subspecialties that are involved in taking care of his illnesses. There are shifts of nurses that come every 8 hours, a new shift of nurses that take care of him. There are paramedical people, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, pharmacists, many other professions. There are lab technicians, there are rentgen technicians, there are many people who are involved in one way or another with this patient. And each and every human being has his own opinion. And if you take those 100 people together and you ask them, how should we treat this patient, you'll get probably 100 different opinions. So who makes the decision? Who is responsible for making decisions? So there are all kinds of ways to do it. Again, I'll skip it. I'm just throwing it for thinking. That is from a secular point of view. Not easy to make real ethical decisions, both fundamentally and practically, in major ethical medical situations. Now let's look at the Jewish side. We are now Rosh Chodesh Elul. I think all these lines here should be taken seriously into account today on a daily behavior of each and every one of us, how to behave ethically from a halachic Jewish point of view. But on each of the four principles, and many more than the four principles, we in Judaism have a statement. Some accept some of the secular definitions and some do not. Now, why are there such differences? First of all, from a Jewish point of view, as an approach, without going into the details, Judaism, at least as formulated in the past 1,000 years of responsa literature, does not build decisions on general principles. And it is almost impossible to do it. And in my view, it is a mistake of the secular medical ethics approach to formulate four principles and to hope that this will solve all the ethical problems that a patient and a physician encounter. Principles are good as guidelines, but they can't solve problems. Why? Because every problem has its own nuances and differences which have to be taken into account. You can't just throw a sentence and hope that 1,000 different situations will fall into this general principle. So you have to look into the specifics of each and every case and give specific rules, regulations, and guidelines, and not just general statements. The response of literature is something which today is called a casuistic approach. Casuistry from the word of case by case, which means that you first analyze the case and you build up towards the principles, rather than taking one or two principles and throwing it on each and every case. In a responsa literature, what we find is that I encounter a situation which has its very specific issues within this particular question. I send this question to a poisek, or I go and ask him, and I present to him the specifics of my case. And when he answers my question, he analyzes each and every part of the specific circumstances and cases, and on each part, he looks what is the real principle applied, and then he balances between the principles. That is how a tshuva is being built, and this is how we should relate to actual, real-life ethical situations. Now, coming to modern life, can halacha compete or answer modern life issues? I stated here a few statements by great poskim and interpreters to show a general approach. But as I said, generality is good only for the teaching of it, but not of solving actual problems which have to be dealt specifically. Nevertheless, the Tiferet Israel says something which I think in modern orthodoxy is not well accepted. The Tiferet Israel makes a rule, and I won't go into the issue in Masechet Yadayim, which is a Masechet that not everyone is learning every day. Only who learns the Mishnah Yomit probably gets to this Masechtot in Taharot. But there is a discussion there which the Tiferet Israel says, everything that we don't know to forbid it is automatically permitted. We don't need to explain why it is permitted. We need to explain why we forbid it. I think it's a little different than what we know today, Chumrah of the Month Club, and today I think it's already Chumrah of the Week Club, and tomorrow it will be Chumrah of the Day Club. Everyone is very easily saying Osur, 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 without giving an explanation. But if you want to say it's Mutar, then you have to break your head, why is it Mutar? That is contrary to the rule of Halacha. Why is the rule of Halacha according to the Tiferet Israel? Tiferet Israel says something very simple. We find in the Torah, in Chazal, only things that are forbidden. The Torah doesn't say that we are allowed to come to Canada to study this weekend. There's no such statement in the Torah. There's nothing in the Torah that says you're allowed to do this, this, and this. This is automatically allowed. What is forbidden is stated, and therefore whatever is not stated is automatically permissible. Now, this is an important rule for poskim, who are real poskim, not those who don't know what to say, and therefore easily they say also, because why get into trouble? But if you want really to answer a question, you have to go over in your mind all of Shas, Rambam, and Shulchan Aruch, and find why it should be also. And if you don't find it, the rule should be it's muta. The Kuzari already said that nothing in the Torah goes against simple knowledge, against something which is simply accepted as correct. That is the rule. Whatever the Torah says it's also is something that doesn't contradict simple scientific knowledge. And therefore, if we can explain scientifically something in a very simple way, we cannot say that it would be forbidden. The Radbaz, on a famous responsa related to an act that was required of a Jew to do in order to save someone else's life, says, it says, Drachea Darchei Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant ways, and therefore the rule is that every psak has to be a psak that it sets on the seichel, on the mind, that it is pleasant to do, not rule something which everyone feels seems to be not pleasant. So again, these are very general rules. The Rambam, dealing with Shabbat, which is one of the most severe prohibitions that we have, whoever works on Shabbat is mechuyav skila, which is the worst punishment that we have in the Torah. Yet, if it has to do with pikuach nefesh, we put aside all of Hilchot Shabbat. And why, says the Rambam, שנאמר אשר יעשה אותם האדם וחי בהם ולא שימות בהם. Our Torah is Torah Chayim, and not a Torah that you should die by it. And hence, if Shabbat may cause someone to die, you put away the Shabbat and you leave the person alive. And says the Rambam, that אלו האפיקורסים שאומרים שזה חילול שבת ואסור, those frumer who says that Shabbos is more important than saving life, עליהם הכתוב אומר, וגם אני נתתי להם חוקים לא טובים ומשפטים לא יחיו בהם. That is not our Torah, says the Rambam, if you don't understand this concept, that the Torah is Torah Chayim. There are some theological issues involved in some of the most modern scientific discoveries, primarily is being discussed nowadays with the genetic improvements that we are witnessing lately, whether it is cloning or PGD, or we will discuss some of the issues throughout this conference. These are fundamental changes in the nature of the world. And some have coined it, not Jews, as playing God. We are now taking the genome and we are changing it and we are taking away genetic diseases that once upon a time, which is still today, were fatal, and we can take out the gene, introduce a new gene, and save the life of a person. This is a form of playing God. This is certainly a form of interference with nature. Are we allowed to interfere with nature, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created? Who are we to change nature in such a drastic way? The Jewish answer is that no one can play God, and if we are successful in doing something, it has nothing to do with playing God, and probably is a permissible interference with nature. And let me just point out one example why it is so. First of all, God, in our understanding, which is very limited, we really don't understand God and we don't know exactly what God is. We know the greatness of his acts, but we don't know God himself. But a fundamental concept in our mind of God is that he can create something from nothing. That is God's deeds. No human being can create something from nothing. All that we are doing, whether it is giving antibiotics to save a patient from an infection, or transplanting an organ from a dead person to a live person and saving his life, or changing the genome of a person, is doing something from something. We are just doing one thing, we're taking one thing, and we are transferring it to another thing, which is saving life. That has nothing to do with playing God. That has nothing to compare with God. We are just using what we have in different ways. The fact that we are sitting here in this very nice hotel, that was not a creation of God. I assume that in the 6 days when God created the world, these buildings did not exist here. So we changed nature. How could we do it? How could we as human beings take this area and beautify it and help us to sit here rather than sit outside now and listening to a lecture in the cold and in the rain? We changed nature. Is it permissible? Yes, it is permissible. And why? So one example, there are many examples to it. It says, "Verapo yerape," and heal should he heal. From here one derives a healer's permission to heal. That's a Gemara in Bava Kamma. That we, physicians, got permission from God to heal. The obvious question is, why did we need to get a permission? Why shouldn't we be able to heal others? Why shouldn't we help other people? And the answer is that we could have said, God smites and man heals. Someone who is sick, why is he sick? There's no chance in the world. He is sick because God wanted him to be sick. So the Hava Amina would have been, who am I as a human being that takes away God's providence and takes away the sickness of this person? So I really should not have been a healer, should not have been a physician, because acting so is interfering with God's will, interfering with nature. Says the Torah, you are mistaken. Verapo yerape. You are allowed to do it. Why are you allowed to do it? Because this is what God wants. God gave us the intellect, the ability, the means to do something good. V'aftal l'racha kamocha. You should do to your fellow man what you should wish for yourself. And this power is empowered by God to the human being to do something which looks as if it is an interfering with nature. So it's clear that we are allowed to be engaged in science, in advancement of science, as long as it is for the good of human beings. It has to be something that the benefit should surpass the detriment. If a human being, an Iranian leader, is thinking to advance science in a nuclear way in order to destroy the world, that is not allowed by Jewish law. But if we are doing it for the benefit of human beings, then we are partners with God and we are allowed to do it. Obviously, there are qualifications to this statement, and for this we need Poskim to tell us whether or not this particular interference by science has to do with halachic prohibitions. And the limits will be where halachic prohibitions do not allow us to use the advancements of nature, and I'll show you a few examples. Now, how do we apply Jewish medical ethics as compared to what we talked about, the application of secular medical ethics? As to polarities, already the Rambam has said that every behavior has two extremes to it. And we should go neither to one extreme nor to the other. We should choose the middle road, the golden middle path. The Rambam's invention of how to behave correctly is not to be very frum and not to be very wicked. It's to be in the middle way, the middle halachic way, which takes a lot of effort to know what it is, but that is the right way. So we have to balance between polarities. Decision making in Jewish law, as far as scientific issues are concerned, requires deep understanding both in the science and in the halacha involved in it. unfortunately, there are very few people who can deal with modern science, and especially modern medical science, because of lack of understanding of the facts of science. And good ethics and good halacha starts with good facts. There is no use and no sense in giving a ruling based on wrong facts, or on missing facts, or on misunderstood facts. And hence, those who pasken without knowing the scientific background of the question really cannot rule halachically. Certainly the other way around. Those who are excellent scientists but know very little halacha, the fact that they learned daf yomi is not sufficient to make decisions on such issues. So you need someone who is really deeply understanding both the scientific and the halachic aspects of the issue. There has to be a calculated, careful balance between stringency and leniency, but it has to be based on halachic ruling and actual circumstances. No generalities, no always going one direction, but each and every time discussing the specific matter with the specific circumstances. Hence, only authoritative poskim should rule on difficult and new issues. That has been the rule for many, many generations. It has become even stronger in our generation, where such a quick pace of new scientific advancement has occurred that very few people are able really to pasken on these issues. I was very privileged to be close to some of such of the poskim, and I saw how they work, and obviously I was privileged to get their decisions on many of the new medical issues, and I think there are very few of them that can do it the way it should be done according to this scheme. And finally, the last part of my talk, I want to show you how lately we were successful, I think, in combining what we call the Jewish and democratic state. Israel is a very unique state in the world at the moment, not unique enough from my point of view. I would have hoped that it would be unique by the fact that it rules only according to halacha. Unfortunately, it's not. Israel is a secular state like most Western societies, but still there is a Jewish aspect to the legislation in Israel, at least lately. And I want to show you a few legislations that passed recently on medical issues that show that this combination of Jewish and democratic is possible, but it is very different than what democratic is understood in Canada or in the United States. There were four recent acts. I won't discuss all of them, and certainly not in detail. Some of them we will discuss during this weekend. I'm just bringing you to your attention that it was possible to do it. One of those is the stem cell research issue, which we'll discuss later, so I won't go into details, but there was a Knesset legislation permitting stem cell research in Israel, which wasn't done in the United States, the very democratic state. They didn't allow it. Only now Obama changed the rulings of Bush, not in a legislative way, but just as a presidential decision. In Israel, it is a law based on the fact that, from a halachic point of view, this research is permissible. And the fact that it became permissible, I, again, was privileged to be helpful in this process. When it started to become a therapeutic way of using blastocysts, which we'll discuss later, I presented the issue to Avi Yashiv. We discussed the scientific aspects of it, and his ruling was that a blastocyst is not a human being in any sense from a halachic point of view, and hence, if it brings benefit to human beings, whether as a PGD testing or as a stem cell testing, that is permissible. And once halacha permitted, the Knesset permitted it. So that was the process in this particular law. The more complicated one, the Dying Patient Act, which was legislated in the Knesset in 2005 and became effective a year later in 2006 and now gradually goes into the country, is a law dealing with a common problem to all states in the world. Everyone is facing the problem, what should you or shouldn't you do with a dying patient? And the law in Israel is very different than the law in the United States, and I think the law in Canada as well. And again, we'll discuss why and how it happened, but it was a long process of understanding the halachic aspects of the dying patient and legislating it in an ethical and legal formula that the secular Knesset accepted it as a law. And finally, the Brain Death Respiratory Act, which was enacted in 2008 and became effective in Israel only 2 months ago, again, is a very unique way of dealing with a very complicated ethical halachic issue, and it, I think the final result is satisfactory to all parties, and again, I discussed it with Rabbi Yashiv, and his interpretation of certain parts was taken into account, and the law really allows both those who are for and against the concept of brain death to live, or rather to die, according to his halachic viewpoint. So again, this is a process that a Jewish democratic state was able to effectuate by the combination of understanding how Jewish ethical deliberations are different than secular ethical deliberations and finding the right balance between them. Thank you.